When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, live on Sundays, 11 to 1, back to our pre-football time here on News Talk WSB. So I can't believe it, but it's Christmas week, and that is very exciting, Christmas in 4 days. So hopefully you are driving safely, finding plenty of places to park in the malls, haha, as you drive around frantically looking for last-minute Christmas gifts. I'm so glad you could join us today. I want to do something a little bit different today. We're going to get some great pieces of advice for you for 2015. This is my gift. One of my gifts to you this year is giving you information that's going to help you land the job of your dreams, help you make the most of your money, and if you're buying or selling, help you avoid making some of the mistakes that so many people make as you march forward through the year. So my first guest is John Challenger, somebody I've known forever. He is the CEO of Challenger Grain Christmas. And Challenger Grain Christmas is a global outplacement firm. And every year they offer a free job advice nationwide. Anybody can call in. This year it's December 29th and 30th and get access to some of the smartest people in the outplacement world. The phone number to call, we're going to give you that in just a minute, so stay tuned for that. But 9 to 5 Central Time, you can call in and get one of John's amazing staff members who will help answer your questions about finding a job. And so I asked John if he'd come on the show today and talk a little bit about some of the challenges facing job seekers next year, although the picture has gotten a whole lot brighter. John, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
So glad to be with you, Elise.
Nice to be with you, too. So the numbers are looking much better than even a year ago. We saw the November job numbers. Wages had started to increase. The number of jobs created was over 321,000, which was capping off a spectacular run, but really the best numbers we've seen in a couple of years. And then on top of it all, you know, and you've got the wages going up, just 1.9, fewer than two people are searching for every job that's available, which is less than half of what it was at the top of the recession. You're the expert. What do you think?
Well, the job market really has turned upside down from where it was in the recession and in its aftermath. Companies today are, in fact, no longer in the driver's seat. It's really a seller's market. Doesn't mean you can just go out and find any job you want. You have to work hard at it, like always. But there's much more receptivity in the part of employers. They're looking for people with good skills who can fit. So it is a very strong job market.
So that's great. So where are the jobs? Are jobs in the digital world? Obviously, engineers are at a premium. I understand college graduates who can code are getting upwards of six figures a year. Where are the good jobs to be had?
Well, the strongest areas are in the skilled areas. So engineering, computer science, technology, healthcare, accountants and finance, not necessarily banks, but people with accounting degrees are the ones most in demand. In the month of November, we saw the category of professional and business services see the highest gains for the month. Over 86,000 new jobs were created, and that includes not only some of the areas I talked about, but also temporary help services, mm-hmm. management and technical consulting services, architectural also. So that's been strong. But retail was strong, and that wasn't just because of the seasonal hiring. Retail jobs grew by 50,000 when it was adjusted for those seasonal gains that occur normally.
Really? That's actually kind of amazing to me that retail is growing when you're seeing the numbers that actually the I think it was Black Friday, the numbers shrank 11% for sales. Seems a little bit of a disconnect, but I know that retailers have been. I went to a store the other day. I was at a local Macy's, And literally, I almost tripped over 16 people who were waiting to take me to somebody to help me complete my purchase. So that's really quite a difference from the way it has been. Go ahead.
Well, it was. Those were some surprisingly low numbers for that Thanksgiving weekend for retail, and yet I think it's going to work itself out. We have over 2.5 million more jobs, people working in those jobs over the last year. In fact, if you look at one report, it says put out by the government of surveying people rather than businesses, there's almost 4 million more people working this year versus last. The wages haven't gone up as much as expected, but they're starting to go up. So I think this holiday season is going to work itself out over time. I think we're going to see gains when it is all said and done.
Well, we will see if you are correct. So looking forward, tell me a little bit about what's your best advice when people are trying to land that job. I had an interview recently with a young woman who wanted to work for me in my digital content agency. This is a job that didn't even exist 10 years ago. And I felt like she just was such a bad match. She hadn't done her research. She showed up. She didn't ask the right questions. Like, if you want to work for a digital agency, you ought to really know about places like Vox and 538.com, and she didn't. But what do you tell people when they're looking for a job?
Well, it's so important today to try and separate yourself out from your competition, and you have to do that. You want to get in person to have a chance to get the job. So you may start out by getting your resume up there electronically and sending it out, but a lot of times you get caught in the thousands of resumes that can come in that way. So finding your way in person to the individual that you're going to work for is key. In fact, each time you get in front of the person who you would potentially be working for, you've really moved your search forward. That's often where people fall back, is they just aren't getting those interviews mm-hmm. with the right people.
Well, that's true. It is very hard to do that. How do you break through? Do you network? Do you go to events where you might run into them? Should you be stalking them on LinkedIn? What's the advice today?
Well, you need to be your most public and external self. So, for example, during this season, if you're looking for work, go to as many holiday parties as you can. And sometimes you just don't feel like that when you're out of work, and yet you have to make yourself get out there, because as you talk with people, you can find not only people who might potentially hire you, but you find people who might introduce you to those people and companies all over your area that help you get in the back door, which is, again, when you're coming in that way, you're not coming in with all the people trying to break in by emailing out their resume. That doesn't mean you shouldn't get your candidacy, your work history up on LinkedIn, because a lot of employers, especially their recruiting arms, are looking through LinkedIn for candidates who really fit their profiles.
Yeah, I'm finding electronically people are reaching out, they're posting things about themselves. Of course, I don't want anybody poaching my employees, but it is great to see that there is so much information available online, and it does help to make a faster decision on the hiring side as well. You kind of know whether or not you want to take it to the next level, and really your advice to get there in person is so important. What's the biggest mistake you see people making these days?
I guess it's just not getting at their search, quickly enough, and staying at it. It is hard when you have been let go from your company, last company, and you shouldn't be blaming yourself. There's so much no fault job loss, but sometimes you do. And then as you go out and see people, you only need one, but it means that everyone up until that point is rejecting you, or at least can feel that way. And so it's easy to get kind of to pull back and say, I'm going to wait for someone to find me. And you just have to stay at it every day. When you find yourself in that mindset, find people that you trust who can talk you through it and get you back up and running. Because if you skip 2 weeks or 3 weeks, licking your wounds because a good one you thought was going to come in didn't, often you're back at square one.
So when you look out at the landscape, we know what areas you think are pretty hot. Are certain locations hot? I mean, this show airs in the greater Atlanta area, but people all over the country, even all over the world, we've got regular listeners in England who I'm sure are tuning in today. But when you look out across the country, what are the hot spots? Are we still seeing that Texas things are growing? What about Atlanta? Are things sort of percolating there? Are there areas of the country where things are not really moving that well?
Generally, you know, this is an economy where everybody, you know, all regions of the country, you know, have, you know, their gains. It's not like there's an area that's slow. Interestingly, Texas, which in the Southwest, which has led the way and been very strong consistently over the last several years, might be slowing a little bit with the energy situation, as there's those energy companies now are not as in great demand as they were. But
yes.
California and the West Coast is hot with all the tech change, very hot area. There's lots of small college towns with unemployment now under 3%. You know, which is way past full employment.
Sure.
So there are shortages beginning to appear in certain areas of the country. You know, and there's some shortages appearing in some of the hot areas we talked about in the beginning in terms of, say, technologists, especially with certain kinds of backgrounds.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable to me that if you come out of certain colleges with a computer science degree, you might even make upwards of $200,000 to $250,000 a year to start, plus, like, location assistance. And it's crazy. We're talking with John Challenger. He's CEO of the global outplacement firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, somebody I've gone to for years for great information about jobs. And every year, Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, this is the 29th annual call-in. They offer free job advice nationwide December 29th and 30th, right? 29th and 30th.
Exactly.
And let me give the phone number out, 9 to 5 Central Time for those 2 days, 312-422-5010. 312-422-5010. Mark it on your calendar. Write the phone number down. We're going to put it up at the website along with more information about what you can get, just so you don't miss this amazing opportunity, because John's people are absolutely just the best. John, if you could stay with us, we'll have a couple of minutes when we come back, and I just want to ask you a little bit about the unemployment rate and searching online job boards. All right? Can you stay with us?
Okay, sure.
All right. I'm Elise Glink. You are listening to The Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One Job at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
A merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
Welcome back, everybody,
well,
to The Elise Glink Show, News Talk WSB, 404-872-0750 is our number. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, where I'm going to be tweeting out about Challenger, Gray, and Christmas's 29th annual free job advice call-in, and you can call the number 312-422-5010. John Challenger, who's CEO of the firm, is with us. So, John, as you look out, people are searching those online job boards. You don't think it's a good idea. What should they do instead?
Well, it's not that I think they shouldn't be searching the online job boards, but you don't want to make it the core area, you know, the only area of your search. I often tell people, get online and do it as much as you want to. Make sure you cover it, but do it after dinner. So you then leave your days to be on the phone or out seeing people or out going to different kinds of events, because it is a personal process. You know, no one's going to hire you until you are there in person, and so you don't want to keep your eye off that ball for too long. And it's just so easy to sit on the computer tinkering with your resume, emailing out hundreds of them and hoping that people will call you, but the common experience is that you just don't get that many interviews that way. Some, but just not enough to sustain your search.
So get out, get current, get connected, and hopefully you're going to get a job in 2015. John Challenger, CEO of Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, thank you so much for being with us and all of your great advice. Really appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thanks.
And don't forget, you should call in 312-422-5010. If you're looking for a job next year, you will not get free advice, better free advice anywhere, not even on this show, than calling Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. So they have this every year. It's the 29th annual. I've been talking about it for the, you know, all the time that I've been on the show. The 29th and 30th of December, make an appointment from 9 to 5 Central, 312-422-5010. If you forget the number, just go to the thinklink.com blog and we will post something on it. All right, when we come back, more gifts for the new year and some help for New Year's resolutions. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Have a happy holiday.
Live and festive in the Publix Holiday Headquarters studio at WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, on WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Glink, and go to thinklink.com and the blog for all the latest, greatest, coolest information from today's show, as well as how to find more on our guests. My next guest is a returning visitor, Jed Kulko. He's the chief economist for Trulia.com and one of the people I most enjoy talking to. And I thought that there's really nobody better than Jed to give us a view of what he thinks is going to happen with next year's housing markets. So whether you're buying or selling, you really want to get the Jed view on what's going to happen. So, Jed, welcome back to the Elise Glink Show.
Thanks very much, Elise. Good to be with you again.
All right, so we've had really a very interesting year. We just heard from somebody who works in the outplacement market that the job market, which honestly has been so moribund since 2008, has now popped up, and we saw in November an amazing jobs number, and I've maintained from the beginning that the housing market is directly connected to jobs. Now we have some jobs. So what did you see happen this year, and what do you see happening next year?
Yeah, well, let's start with jobs. And what's particularly important is jobs for young adults, because that's the age group when people think about moving out of their parents' homes or moving out of a roommate situation and into their first place, usually first as renters, but then as buyers. For young adults, and remember, they had a particularly bad recession. You know, their unemployment rate went way up. This year, we saw some good improvement in the job market for them. The share of them who are working is considerably higher now at the end of 2014 than at the start of the year. They still got a ways to go. The employment picture for young adults still is far from where it was before the recession, but there's been a fair amount of improvement this year. And that's actually fueling a lot of rental demand. That's where we're going to see the first effect of young people getting back to work.
All right, so we've got rental numbers going up. I know when I see the new construction housing numbers every month, we're seeing rental units or multifamilies, they're often called. Those are the numbers that are spiking. Single-family home construction, not so much.
Single-family home construction is still not much better than about half of normal levels.
Right.
And that recovery has been much slower. Again, part of the reason is that much of the demand is on the rental side. And very few single-family homes are built for rent. There are a lot of single-family homes out there that are being rented, often by people who lost a home to foreclosure.
Sure.
But those typically don't tend to be newly built homes. The other thing, of course, is we built a lot of single-family homes during the bubble, whereas we didn't overbuild apartments. And so the need to build more housing has come faster for apartments than for single-family homes.
So we're building now the stuff that renters, young adults, need to rent, which is great. And then what's going to happen next year?
I think next year we will continue to see multi-unit construction, mostly apartment construction, leading the construction recovery. We're still at the point where young adults are starting to move out of their parents' homes. They're not going to be buying as much as renting. Builders are going to keep building for this rental demand. And remember, the most common age right now in the U.S. is 23. So when we're thinking about young people, thinking about millennials, think about the early 20s. You know, that's an age for which home buying is still a few years away. You shouldn't be thinking about 30-year-olds or 32-year-olds. We have more 23-year-olds right now in the U.S. than any other age.
So this is sort of interesting, and I guess we're looking out beyond 2015, but hey, what the heck. So younger people are finally starting to rent. We didn't see that happen for a while. There's a bubble of 7 years of young people who are now 30, and they should be renting, but they've had 7 years, or I should say they should be getting ready to buy, but they've had 7 years where they've been living with their parents. They haven't really been saving their money. They've been out of work or not finding jobs that were paying anything. Do we have a lost half generation out there that will, down the line over the next few years, severely impact the way that people buy homes. And conversely, we've seen home prices bubble up already, and while interest rates are at kind of historic lows still, I mean, I couldn't believe this, but I saw recently 3.5% on a 30-year fixed again. So we're seeing this historic low. Those numbers are going to go up as well as the economy improves. And affordability, that's just not a good mix. So how do you see that happening?
Well, first of all, I think there is a lost generation, but it's slightly older folks. Folks who are in their mid to late 30s and in their 40s, because those are the people who were old enough during the bubble to have bought homes and then lost them to foreclosure. They're the ones who now have a tough time getting a mortgage because
right.
it's harder to get a mortgage after a foreclosure or short sale. And that's the group for which the home ownership rate looks lower than you'd expect today, given the long-term demographic shifts that we've seen. See, for younger people, first of all, they were too young to have bought homes during the bubble. You know, even, you know, 30-year-olds today were only in their early 20s during the height of the bubble.
Right.
But they weren't the folks who were, you know, buying those homes. But also, there's been a long-term shift over several decades of marrying and having kids at later ages. And that actually explains a lot of the decline in homeownership among young adults because the age of homeownership has gone up.
Sure. And it's, I think, 31 and a half or 32 now, and expected to go to maybe 33, 34, which is truly older and I think probably a point of consternation for realtors everywhere. But what happens when they get there, I guess?
I expect we will see more of them buying homes. I don't think there's been a fundamental shift in the aspiration or the dream of buying a home. You know, when we survey consumers, 74% still say that homeownership is part of their personal American dream, and 93% of young renters tell us that they plan to buy a home someday.
So that's sort of interesting. 74% is lower than the historic numbers I remember from a decade or two ago when it was more like 86%. Or am I remembering incorrectly?
So we've asked this question of consumers over the past 5 years, and 74 is same as last year and higher than the previous years.
Okay.
So that 74% number, the way we've asked it in our surveys, is a pretty strong number, and it's been rising among young adults. So 78% of young adults say that homeownership is part of their personal American dream.
Okay. So it sounds like people are thinking about it and hoping to achieve it. And we know how hopes and dreams go forward. They push us all forward. So what are, if somebody's going forward into the new year, they're planning to buy or sell, what are some trends that you're thinking about that might be helpful to them?
One of the things that consumers told us in the latest Trulia survey is that they think 2015 is going to be a much better year to sell a home than 2014 was.
Hmm.
Prices have risen. There's increasing demand. So I expect that means we're going to see more existing homeowners trying to sell their homes next year. And that means more inventory on the market. It'll give buyers more to choose from, and it will be a somewhat easier process for buyers to find something that works for them, just because there'll be more inventory on the market.
Well, that's kind of nice, the idea that there is something more to choose from, that an investor isn't swooping up with cash to buy before you can even make an offer. I mean, that's very discouraging when you're out there and you're looking for a house. And as a first-time home buyer, so your funds are generally limited, you're really always stretching to the very, very edges, that not that the mortgage lenders like it, and then somebody swoops in with cash and goes, well, I'll just pay that, and it's taken. What do you think of, and I don't know what you're hearing in your side of the fence, but what do you think of the idea that conventional lenders will now do a 3% down payment again?
I think that will have probably a modest effect on the housing market. You know, there are many people for whom, you know, the 3% instead of 5% is not going to make the difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for people who are just starting to get back on their feet economically, they're not confident enough about their income, they're not sure they're going to stay put in the same home or city for enough time to make it worthwhile, you know, that difference in the down payment might not make the difference for them. we might see other measures that expand the availability of mortgage credit next year in addition to that lower down payment.
Like what?
So there are other rules about whether Fannie and Freddie will require banks to take back loans, other things that might expand the availability of credit, not just for those more creditworthy borrowers, but for others as well. But at the same time, we expect rates are going to go up. So in the end, it will probably mean that it'll get easier to get a mortgage, but it'll cost more because rates will be higher.
You know, the whole idea of bubble is just, I think, still so close, where we made it so easy to get a loan. Anybody with a pulse could get a loan, pulse and a good credit score. Are the checks and balances in place, do you think, to prevent us from getting into a situation like we did the last time? Because frankly, I don't know that anybody's prepared mentally to withstand another great recession.
Well, first of all, we are not close to bubble conditions again.
No, not saying we are, but...
No. We're not close either in terms of where prices are today or in terms of the ease of getting a mortgage or in terms of the overbuilding that happened last decade.
Mm-hmm.
On none of those measures does it look like we're in a bubble today.
Okay.
I think, one of the ways in which the world of lending has changed is that the types of toxic mortgages that were part of last decade's bubble are now outside the set of mortgages that qualify under the new mortgage rules. And so we're much less likely to see widespread lending with that kind of mortgage again. And so that's, hopefully a permanent change going forward.
Right. So hopefully we're not seeing people who earn $50,000 buying $500,000 homes.
Right.
Right. which was never a good idea when it was going on 10 years ago.
Which is
not a good idea.
It's inevitable that there will be some kind of bubble somewhere someday in the future.
Of course. It's the world.
But,
it's the economy.
But it's unlikely that we're going to have exactly the same bubble for exactly the same reason.
Well, that would be because we actually might have learned a lesson and prevent it. So, of course, it'll happen in some other place. We've got Jed Kolko with us. He's the chief economist for Trulia.com. Stay tuned. We'll come back for a final word with Jed next on WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Link Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. It's Christmas week. You're hearing all the Christmas music. Very, very exciting. I have Jed Kolko with me. He is the chief economist for Trulia.com. In today's show, we're talking about all kinds of things that you can expect to see next year when it comes to getting a job, buying a house, selling a house, the economy in general. At the end of the show, I'm going to have my New Year's resolutions for you, for buying, selling, and for your personal finances. Jed, any final thoughts on what people can expect if they're buying or selling? Or maybe the best thing to say is, where do you, when all things are said and done at the end of 2015, where do you think things will be?
I think the market will continue to feel more and more normal. Fewer foreclosures, fewer distressed sales. Price gains won't be rising quite as much.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thing to remember is that affordability will probably worsen next year. Prices still rising faster than incomes, and mortgage rates are likely to rise. So homeownership will cost more in 2015 than it did in 2014.
So you don't think mortgage interest rates will rise this year either in 2015?
No, I think prices will rise faster than incomes and mortgage rates will rise.
Will rise. So were you surprised, because I know I was a little surprised, that mortgage interest rates are ending the year basically lower than where we started in 2014, despite everybody saying that this year we would see interest rates over 5% by the end of the year. And I, of course, repeated that to everybody. And then middle of the year, I said, you know what, course correction, either the economy's not as strong as we think or something, but it just doesn't seem to be working in the right direction. So in 10 seconds or less, were you surprised?
I was surprised. I was with all the other economists expecting rates to rise this year. They didn't. I'm expecting it again next year. We'll see if that prediction's any closer to true.
Right. We will see. All right. You can find Jed's blog online at Trulia.com, and it's wonderful. Beautifully written blog, I have to just say. Kudos to you, Jed. It's just great. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Have a happy holiday. We will be back in a moment. More advice for you as you move through Christmas and to January 1st of 2015. Stay tuned to the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Klink is live, answering your money and real estate questions. Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours. News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on WSB. Christmas week! I love this week, and you're going to hear Christmas music all through the show. We just love doing that. And, of course, here on WSB, we've got the Christmas Day thing happening with music. It's all good. And you're probably out shopping. Be safe as you're driving. Don't fight over parking spaces at the malls. Trust me, you'll find one. Just keep going around and around and around. We are in the middle of an amazing show. This is one of my big gift shows to you. I want you to have all the best information. If you're looking for a job, if you're buying a house, if you're fixing your personal finances in 2015, we have amazing people on the show today to tell you exactly how to do it. Liz Handland is the CEO of UltimateResumes.com. She has been on the show many, many times. She's one of my favorite guests because she so clearly articulates what it takes today to put your resume together and get it out there in a way that gets it noticed. Liz, welcome back to the program.
Elise, thanks for having me back. This is one of my favorite things to do.
Well, this works out well then. So the whole concept of resume strategy, which I just love when you talk about it, and I really want to start there, even though it's probably at the bottom of the list for you. But I think if you don't have a strategy for how you're going to find the job of your dreams, you're never going to find it.
That's absolutely right. Looking for a job is no different than accomplishing anything else in life that you want to achieve. If you want to lose weight, you set goals, reasonable goals and steps. If you want to save money, a topic near and dear to your heart,
oh, yeah.
You save a little bit every day or every week. It's the same thing with a job search strategy. You create a target list of companies. You research those companies. You figure out who do I need to meet within each company. And then you reach out to them. You make your case. The resume should follow you into the room rather than lead your way into the room. And this strategy is that you're going to create, you think of it as sort of a timeline, a roadmap for getting from A, which is where you are now, to B, your new job.
All right. This is maybe the best sentence I've heard you say out of many, many good ones. The resume should follow you into the room, not lead you into the room. For so many people, they send out these resumes, I don't know, it's like their target practice or something. Like just anybody, they're going to spray the room and hope something sticks. But really what you're saying is find the target company or the category of companies, find those target people, figure out what they're looking for, try to match that up, be strategic about it, and then and only then create the resume for that job. Is that what you're getting at?
Basically, yes. Now, you're not necessarily going to create a separate resume for every job, because the reality is we all have a certain skill set and certain accomplishments that are pretty much the same. But what you want to do is figure out for any given company, what problem do they need solved? What problem, and then what you have to know for yourself, what problems can you solve? What business challenges are you great at handling? And then apply to companies that, A, have problems you can solve, and, B, that's what you want to talk about, right? So you don't want to talk about, hey, I want a job, and I'm just going to send my resume out scattershot and hope that somebody hires me. It's got to be a lot more specific than that. We are all hired to solve a problem, whatever that problem or challenge may be. So you've got to identify those, and that's all part of your job search strategy, and then reach out to individuals, make your case, and only then give them the resume. You don't just send it out and hope that somebody interprets it in the right way and understands what problem you can solve.
So Liz, if you've identified and you've got this amazing strategy, let's get a little bit more technical. What should you be doing with your LinkedIn profile?
The LinkedIn profile has become ever more important. the first thing that you want to do is make sure that your resume and LinkedIn are consistent. They don't have to be exactly the same information, because in some cases you may not want the whole world to be able to see, for example, your sales numbers for 2013.
Oh, right.
But you want to make sure that the information is consistent. So, for example, if you've listed every company you've worked for on your resume, do the same for LinkedIn and vice versa. You don't want anyone to look at your LinkedIn and see your resume and think that you're being duplicitous in any way.
Right, and it's really important that there shouldn't be errors anywhere up and down the line, which is so easy to do with LinkedIn.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting, when we get resumes, and we get all kinds of resumes now, the first thing we do is we go and we search in Google for all the different links that are attached to that person. So we search for LinkedIn, but we're also looking for their Facebook page. We're looking for their YouTube channel. We're looking for a Reddit stream if they use their real name. Most people don't. We're trying to figure out who these people are offline as well as online, because we think it tells so much about the quality and character of the person that we're hiring, and we're so careful about culture. What are you seeing? Clearly, we're seeing a lot of stuff that should not be out there, but what are you telling people who come to you for advice?
What I tell them is to think about what you want everyone to be. What do you want your brand to be? So, for example, if you're 24 years old and you're involved in social media, if that's your job, for example, if you're involved in social media marketing, then you want to make sure that you have a Twitter account, a Facebook account, a link, that you have all of those things,
right,
and that everything on them is appropriate and reflects your brand. So if you're, again, in this example, 25-year-old social media expert, if your brand is edgy and hip, then that's fine. But if you're 45 years old and you work for a bank, for example, you don't want to have probably that same level of information or same level of edginess out there. Whatever you have online needs to reflect who you are and what you want everyone to know about you.
Right. And I think this goes for Facebook as well, because if you are, you know, in your 30s, let's say, and you have Facebook, or you're 20 and you have your, you know, like my friend's kids who are looking for their first internships and they're in college, you just don't want your beer drinking pictures up there. You don't want, you know, those really, really short, inappropriately low-cut dresses that you might have worn on a date. It should be the first thing that a potential hirer sees, because it could create a completely inaccurate description of who you are in their minds.
Well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, there are some employers who will not hire young people, particularly right out of college, if they find things that they find to be unflattering on Facebook or any of these social media sites. So you do want to be really careful of what you put out there. And what you see more often with folks who are, say, in their 30s and 40s is that they go on Facebook and sometimes they'll have political rants, things like that. Those can also be used against you. So general rule of thumb is, if you're not in social media, I would lock down that Facebook page, understand your privacy settings. If you use Facebook primarily just for fun and to communicate and share baby pictures, that kind of thing, there's no need for an employer to see that.
Oh, absolutely not. I wouldn't want anybody to see that. And, you know, most of my friends' kids have now locked down, the ones in college, have now locked down their Facebook pages, so you're not seeing anything. And also don't allow, use to choose the highest privacy setting, so you're not allowing anybody who you're friends with to share your pictures elsewhere, because that also can get out.
That's absolutely right. And understanding privacy settings on all social media is so important, and it's something that you should check on about once a month, because they change them frequently. With LinkedIn, though, what you want to make sure is that your privacy settings reflect the folks you want to see your profile. So you can make your LinkedIn profile unsearchable. You can block certain people. You can do all kinds of things to limit it. But if you're in an active job search and you want to make yourself very searchable, you probably want to loosen those a little bit.
Right. And there's a reason that, you know, LinkedIn has some wonderful opportunities for you to post samples of your work. We just posted on our LinkedIn page that I received an honor from a magazine, and I thought, hey, let's just put this up on the site, and we did. And so that's a great thing for people to see. And of course, every time you make a change on LinkedIn, your entire network sees it. And so you might want to increase your network. This is a great time by trying to connect with people to build that, you know, network, so that you're more LinkedIn, I guess, to a lot of other people. It's really nice. Good piece of advice for, let's just do biggest mistake first. Biggest mistake in 30 seconds that people are making with their resumes?
Negativity.
Really?
Yes. I have talked to a few unhappy job seekers recently who overcompensate by either putting so much detail on their resume that it looks like they're trying too hard, or they put negative information on there, like, you know, boss was difficult to work for. Like, they're trying to communicate too much, and it just makes them seem weird, and it raises questions. So someone is, they're probably not going to get a call from a recruiter or hiring manager.
Yeah, weird information. It does stand out, doesn't it? There's kind of a,
absolutely,
like a weird thing about it. All right, best thing you've seen on a resume in the last 6 weeks?
Ooh, best thing. Well, actually, I'm working with a colonel in the Army, and the best thing I saw on the resume was that he was a Purple Heart. How about that?
That is really cool. I think that actually is very meaningful. I saw somewhere that a resume or a CV, you could have one page for every 10 years of career. Is that a good rule?
I think it's basically a good rule, but it's not a hard and fast rule. You have to tell your story. Let the content drive the length. But up to a point. I would say generally you don't want to have a resume that goes beyond 3 pages and then maybe 4 if you're on a lot of boards or have patents or awards or publications. You don't want to go too crazy with it, but you don't want to create an artificially shortened document to fit, you know, some preconceived idea that people will or will not read more information. If it's compelling and if it's well written, they'll read it.
Sounds good. We're talking with Liz Hanlon. She's CEO of UltimateResumes.com, UltimateResumes.com. She's based in Austin, but she works with people all over, and she's the author of the ultimate book of sample thank you and sympathy notes, which I just love. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about those thank you notes, because I think they are very important, and many times they are overlooked. I'm Elise Glink. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one job at a time, hopefully starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
I'll be so blue, just thinking.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours in WSB. Liz Hanlon is on the line with me. She is CEO of UltimateResumes.com. We are giving you all the best job advice that you need so that you can have a great job search in 2015. When we left, I said to Liz, we have to talk about thank you notes, because oftentimes I just don't even get one, not even by email. What do you advise your clients is best practice?
Handwritten thank you notes, hands down. You can also send an email thank you. In fact, it's nice to do both. But if you send a handwritten thank you note, you will stand out, because it shows that you cared enough to spend an extra few minutes writing something out, thinking about it, and putting it in the mail.
Is it okay to ask somebody for a card so that you
Absolutely.
Have their exact spelling and the and every single thing? Because a lot of times there's these mail drops, and so the, you know, the written address is not quite the same as the email address. What do you think?
I think it's not only absolutely all right to do it, I think it's very respectful. I think it shows that you care enough to take the time to, number one, ask. Again, it's going to a little bit of extra trouble to let somebody know how much you appreciated their time and effort,
which I think is always a good thing. I hate it when I don't get, my team laughs at me, but if I don't get an email thank you by the end of the day or at the very latest the next morning, I almost discount that person. I just feel like they didn't respect the time that I gave them enough to say anything. And then if I do extend a job offer, whether or not you're going to take it right away, I want to know you got the email. And so people that respond instantly, I love that. And if they don't, not so much.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that a lot of companies or a lot of individuals, just like yourself, they view that as a lack of enthusiasm for the job. If you're excited about a job and you really want it and you loved meeting all the people that you met, say so. Say so right away.
Yeah.
I took someone to lunch recently, a young woman who wants some mentoring, and she was wonderful. We had a wonderful lunch. It's been 2 weeks, and I haven't heard a word. Not an email. It makes me wonder a little bit if she's going to become as successful as she wants to be.
Wonder a little? I got to say, I wouldn't waste one more minute with her. I think she sort of missed the boat, right?
Absolutely. Well, and I was planning to introduce her to a lot of decision makers, really help her out. But now I think, hey, if you don't have the sense to at least send a thank you via email, I bought her lunch and everything. So these are little mistakes that you just don't need to make. It's so easy to say thank you one way or another, and there's no such thing as being too grateful in this world.
Right. I completely agree. Liz Handlin, she is the CEO of Ultimate Resumes, the place to go for information on resumes, ultimateresumes.com. She writes a great blog, and she's the author of the ultimate book of sample thank you notes and sympathy notes. Liz, as always, lots of great information. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, and have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you. I will. You do the same, and I know we'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thanks. Have a great evening.
Thank you. It is 28 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time. When we come back, some New Year's resolutions for you from me. Stay tuned to WSB.
Live and festive in the Publix Holiday Headquarters studio
at WSB.
Elise Glink, Sundays on News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. You know, I can't believe that this is finally Christmas week. And, you know, for anybody who's celebrating Christmas or Hanukkah, which starts on, I think, Tuesday night, or last Tuesday night, this is just a very, very special time of year, and it's very family-oriented, and everybody's sort of thinking about New Year's and what's going to happen. Next week on the show, we're going to give you some more suggestions from our tax experts on some things that you can do before the end of the year so that you can make the most of next year's tax season in April. But right now, what I want to do is share with you some of the things that I've been thinking about New Year's resolutions. And every year I do this, I talk about things that you can do, resolutions you should make if you're buying a house, resolutions you should make if you're selling a house, and of course, personal finance resolutions for everybody, whether you're buying or selling, or you're staying in your house, you're refinancing. These are some things that you might want to do because it's going to really benefit you over the course of not just 2015, but for years to come. So as we turn the dial, and I look back over 2014, and I think we have come so far. Do you remember in the first quarter of 2014, we talked about how there was this huge contraction economically? Do you remember? I mean, it's like the economy just sort of went, and just almost had another heart attack. And then we had such a horrible winter. There was all kinds of hangovers, not to mention like flooding from the winters. And we turned it around in the second, third, and now fourth quarter of the year, and things look like they're on a much better place. Now, I don't know what's going to happen in the first quarter of 2015, but in the meantime, we've got the price of gas at the pump is super low. I am seeing in some places around the country, people are paying $2 a gallon or even less. And millions of Americans have finally taken advantage of super low interest rates to refinance. Even the person who called last week or the week before, she said, yeah, I'm still at 5.5%. I guess it's really time to refinance. Yes, if you have not refinanced, please jump off this fence and go and refinance. Get some quotes. Yes, it's harder for you to qualify. Yes, you have to have more paperwork. Yes, it's going to be annoying. But if you could save $200, $300, $400 a month, that's $4,800 a year, and that is real money in anybody's book. In fact, that money can go directly into your Roth IRA, right? Hopefully you're already saving in your 401k, but your Roth IRA could fund it. And can you imagine the savings of putting in $4,800 a year for the next 20 years? It's real money. The best message that I can give you as we go into 2015 is this. If you need to rebalance your budget, do it. Work on the big ticket items first, the places where you can really make a difference. And then once the big stuff is taken care of, right, that's like the mortgage or that's like finding a cheaper place to rent, then you can work on all the smaller items. Think of it in terms of dollars and cents, right? First, you focus on where you can save some dollars, and then it's all the pocket change that you can put away in a real or imaginary jar that sits on your shelf. I've got mine. I've described it before. Maybe I'll even post a picture of it. It's the jar that my grandmother used, one of her old jelly jars. And I use that, and I still throw my change in it and some dollar bills and all the rest. And over time, it has just added up to a ridiculous amount of money. So let me give you a few very specific personal finance resolutions so you can get your 2015 off to a great start. And then I'm going to give you a few resolutions if you are buying a home next year or selling your home next year. So let's start with number one. You've got to love the concept of deferred gratification. And here's what I mean by that. If you don't need it today, don't buy it. It's just that simple. It doesn't matter that it's on sale. If you don't buy it, it's still cheaper than buying it on sale. Now, for most things, if you wait a week or a month before you actually pull the plug and buy, the urge to purchase that item is going to diminish. And if it doesn't, then, you know, you probably actually need it. And then you can spend some time looking for the best price in that item. But if you're like most people, what ends up happening is when you do deferred gratification, it goes away. That need, that impulse to spend because you're going to fill up something deep inside, that hole in your heart, that's not a real thing. And buying something is not going to make you feel any better. So love the concept of deferred gratification and watch your savings grow. My second resolution for you is pay off your credit card debts. The average American has about $8,000 in credit card debt. Most people also have a mortgage, a car loan, and still some sort of student loan to pay off. College grads are leaving school with $20,000 in credit card debt on top of federal and private student loans. The student default rates are skyrocketing. So here's the bottom line with debt. You are never going to get rich if you have a boatload of debt, especially debt you're paying off at a high interest rate. And these days, 8 and 10% and 12% is extremely high when mortgage interest rates are less than 4%. So do what it takes to pay off your non-deductible debts as fast as possible. And then finally, make saving a priority, because we know that you've been told if you save the first dollar you make and the last, that's great, but you've got to make it fun. You've got to make it a priority because life is increasingly expensive. And saving for retirement, even if it's decades away, is a necessity. So trying to put $25 a paycheck away, and when that becomes easy, up that to 50, and then 75, and 100, and then 1,000, and pretty soon you're going to have a big pot of money. Those three things alone are going to make you much more secure financially in 2015 and beyond. All right, home buyer resolutions. So what do you do? It's been a better year, but buyers are finding themselves kind of scrambling to get their offers accepted, especially the first-time buyers. That market particularly, real estate investors are coming in and they're snapping it all up, often paying with cash. And sellers who were nervous about first-time buyers qualifying were taking less money for their houses, but the surety of cash, right? Cash pays. So if you're finding it hard, you need to go out and make sure that you actually qualify for those loans. And it's really hard if you're self-employed and you've been self-employed for less than 2 years. You may not even be able to qualify for a mortgage. But mortgage interest rates are still near historic lows, as you heard Jed Kolko from Trulia.com say earlier in the show. You know, we all thought mortgage interest rates were going up. They didn't, so maybe they won't again this year. I think they're still going to be pretty good this year. You should try to refinance or buy. So how do you do that? Here's some resolutions for you. Number one, understand your credit history and credit score. You know, for better or worse, this information rules your financial life. So you can go to annualcreditreport.com, get a free copy of your credit report from the three credit reporting bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, pay $9 for your score if you want, and then you'll need to work on, over time, raising your credit score by improving your credit history. And if you want a ton of free information on that, go to the Equifax Finance blog, which I'm the managing editor of, and we have just a ton of great free credit information that will really help educate you and make this job a whole lot easier. All right, resolution number two, find the best loans on the best terms. And that means you got to do your homework. So despite the government securing or guaranteeing nearly all the loans through Fannie, Freddie, and FHA, banks offer different terms. Mortgage lenders, mortgage brokers, everybody's got a different spin on it. Be sure you look at the customer service record from the lender. Or as Clark likes to say, don't go with somebody with a customer no service record, because that's just going to be really irritating. So here's how you find that out. Put the lender's name and the word complaints in a search engine and see what comes up. When you get a loan with that person or that company, that's the customer service record you're buying. So know that going in, not out. And then my last piece of advice, which is good for buyers or sellers, build the best home buying or home selling team. So whether it's an investment property you want to buy or sell, a home to live in, an apartment that you're going to rent out, you need a team of real estate professionals who will help you find the right property at the right price, on the right terms. Hopefully, you're going to need a real estate agent, a mortgage, a tax preparer with doing that, and a real estate home inspector, and that's just to start. If you're going to be investing, you want to add a 1031 exchange professional and commercial, if appropriate. Go to thinklinkstore.com. Check out my intentional investor series, How to Be Wildly Successful. 75% off. Best deal I can give you. It's break even for us, right? 75% off. Use the code BUYNOW, B-U-Y-N-O-W. It goes into such detail for people who want to get into this. You've got to know what's coming. This is a great way to do it. And then a few other resolutions for home sellers. Job to overcome any possible objections a buyer would have, right? Buyers are always looking for a reason not to buy your house. That's just how it is. They have a million houses to choose from, and your job is to eliminate any potential objections that would stand in the way for a buyer to make an offer. So you've got to exceed the buyer's expectations of your home. If it's competitively priced and your home's condition exceeds the buyer's expectations of other homes in the neighborhood, you're going to get an offer, even if it isn't the offer you want. And then that's a different issue. So get your home into selling shape, clean it, you know, maybe even hire a stager. Make sure you go do the touch-ups. Need to update your landscaping? That's a good idea. Think about whether it's worth it to replace the carpet. And then invite 3 agents to do the comparative marketing analysis. They're going to tell you what other homes like yours are selling for, what condition they're in. They're your eyes and ears on the ground. Again, goes back to what I just said. You need a great home selling team. Your agent is the person who's going to lead the way. I get this question a lot. Can you actually go and sell on your own? Sure. Absolutely, you can sell on your own. And if you want to do that and take on the marketing job as well as the homeowning job, more power to you. Give yourself 3 weeks, price your home super competitively, do everything you need to do online and offline, and if you don't get an offer in 3 to 4 weeks, consider listing with a professional. Because if you're at that place, that's all it takes. Right? If you've gotten everything, all of your ducks in a row, if you're realistic about the marketplace, all of that, then you can sell on your own and at least try to sell on your own. And if it doesn't work, fine. It doesn't work. At least you're never going to look back and go, gosh, I wish I had tried that. All right. When we come back, a few final thoughts as we head into the end of the year. It's almost Christmas, folks. What could be more exciting? I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live, answering your money and real estate questions. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. News 95.5 and AM 750, WSB.
To behold the wonderful
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Unicorn Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours in WSB. So one of the things that I miss the most about this time of year is hearing my old friend and WSB voice for so many years, Mike Cavanaugh, who used to host Money Matters before Wes Moss came along, and he would always say at the end of the show, ho, 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 Merry Christmas, Elise Glink, and then it would lead right into my show. So I do miss that, and I think about Mike. And for those of you who have been listeners for a long time on WSB, I know that you think about Mike this time of year, too. He was just an amazing guy. And we think about Captain Herb, and we think about everybody that we have lost. It's just that kind of year, you know, time of year. Very, very, very special time to be here with you on WSB. So I want to make the offer again. If you are interested, go to thinklinkstore.com. Use the code BUY now. Get 75% off of my Intentional Investor Series. But there's all kinds of great stuff there. If you want to give somebody the gift of information, this is a great place to start. If it's about personal finance, buying a home, selling a home, uncluttering, decluttering your house, we've got information that will help make it all work better for them. So take advantage. Go to thinklinkstore.com. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Glink. Go to thinklink.com/blog for all of the information for today's guests. I want to make sure that they are getting, that you are getting all of their information so you can follow up with them this year and into the new year. And I do just want to give you one last hit. John Challenger was on our show right at the very beginning. He's the CEO of Challenger Gray & Christmas. They are a global outplacement firm, and they have an office in Atlanta as well. They, once a year, do the free job advice call-in number. And this is the 29th year they've been doing it. It's December 29th and 30th. 29th and 30th, Monday and Tuesday of next week. You can call 312-422-5010 and get free, amazing job advice. And please, if you are going to look for a job this year, take advantage. Call John Challenger. Call his people, 312-422-5010, for the free job advice hotline. All right, Merry Christmas, everybody. I hope it is a wonderful season. Have a happy rest of Hanukkah. And we will have tax advice next week, and then I will be back in the new year with a whole other year of great information for you. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on WSB. Christmas.